This is Common Ground. Islamic fundamentalism is said to be the biggest threat to U.S. security today. That's just not the case, says my guest today, an Iranian scholar. But Americans have bought that idea. Witness the immediate reaction to the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building last April.
It was evidence of something I fear in this country, and that is the unleashing of ugly sentiments. The mass hysteria as a result directed against Muslims. I fear it. And yes, I was relieved, but not less appalled, that the terrorists this time were Americans and not Muslims. But it doesn't mean that it may not occur again, that some crazy Muslim terrorist will have an act of violence in the United States. I understand the Western world needs a new enemy, but Islamic fundamentalism is not it.
Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. 16 years ago, Islamic revolutionaries overthrew the U.S.-backed government of the Shah of Iran. Clerics interpreted Islamic law to claim ultimate political and religious authority, even imposing rules on such things as personal dress, like the one that requires women to wear the traditional headscarf in public. Scores of opponents to the new regime were lined up and shot, and the U.S. Embassy was attacked and its occupants taken hostage. My guest today is Mongal Bayat, who is currently teaching the history of Iran at the University of Bonn in Germany. She was blacklisted in the early days of the revolution and went into exile, though she says things have loosened up some now and she can go back to her country. We begin today discussing why the Iranian Revolution was the first in a series of political movements by Islamic fundamentalists in the Middle East, and what this movement means to the nation-state so carefully nurtured in this 20th century.
I see a link in the sense that this is a common trend on the part of some Islamic movements in the Arab world, in Iran first, that first and foremost discredit the whole idea of a secular nation state and discredit the idea of secular laws, and have in common the call for the reapplication of Islamic law. But there is a difference between the Iranian Revolution, which was practically bloodless.
Unlike in Algeria, where we're seeing 20,000 now.
And in Egypt currently, though I'm not sure Egypt is that far in the process of a revolution, but Algeria is. Not only comparing the two, the Iranian and the Algerian experience, is there a difference in terms of violence, but also in terms of the participants. The Iranian revolution in the beginning saw the formation of a very successful coalition of various revolutionary groups. A number of them were secularists. Not all of them were Islamists. Not all of them, even those who spoke the language of Islam, but not all of them went along with Khomeini's original idea of bringing to power the religious scholars, religious leaders, and enforcing the law of Islam. So you had a very, very successful closing of ranks of all the groups. But in Algeria, you don't see that. In Algeria, you see a strictly Islamist, a radical Islamist group, intransigent, not wanting to work with anybody else but people who share their views, and of course resorting to violent means. There is a tremendous difference.
Why do you think we saw the revolution first in Iran? Was there any particular reason? Was it just because these groups could come together and form a coalition? And were these seeds of revolution also present in other countries, but they just didn't have the ability to coalesce and form a major opposition to the secular governments?
I'm going to give you here my own perspective, because different experts have a different analysis of what went or what happened and what are the causes. My perspective is that this revolution was not meant to be an Islamic revolution. It was a national revolution. This is why I say it was so successful in bringing together all the various opposition groups, from moderate to extreme radical, radical being secular leftist or radical extremist Islamists, because the various participants had only one thing in common, and that was to achieve a revolution. But only one segment of the participants aimed at Khomeini's view of establishing the rule of the theologian. The others were not. The fact that it ended up with a triumph of Khomeini and his followers and his political doctrine does not mean that it started as an Islamic revolution. It started as a national revolution. In Algeria, what is happening now is very different. The revolutionaries are indeed the Islamists and the radical Islamists, with one goal only.
And when you talk about the revolution in Iran, was it a revolution against Western ideas as it was so often portrayed?
My perspective is definitely not. Mm-hmm. It was a revolution against the autocracy of the Pahlavi regime.
That's the Shah.
That's the Shah. It was not just the Shah, but the whole state of the Pahlavis.
The corruption.
It was a revolution that included highly politicized, highly educated, modern educated professional, as well as the less educated, poorer classes. And what they had in common was their demand for greater participation in the political process. This is what the rallying point was.
And did they get that?
They got a worse regime.
Yes, no participation, essentially, or no voice.
And loss of all the achievements that took almost 100 years attain.
These are the achievements that led to the creation of a secular nation state?
That's right. A modern society, modern infrastructure, social opportunities, economic opportunities for not just the rich, but for the middle class and the lower middle class. And these opportunities did not exist in the pre-modern period. Opportunities existed only for the wealthy, the upper classes. But in the 20th century, as a result of modernization of society, you saw the rise of a middle class that by 1979 was self-confident enough to demand the right to participate in the political process.
The picture that we get of Iranian society today here in the U.S. is a very grim, repressive society. Is that a very accurate picture? And I'm assuming that in private life things must be very different, and that the country overall is changing since those early days of the revolution in 79.
I think that there's one basic historical truth, and that is social change is irreversible. And in particular, the laws pertaining to the status of women in society, all the laws that gave her a higher status and allowed her greater freedom. And these laws were enacted in the 20th century. have not been abrogated by the Islamic regime. They're still in effect. Now, having said that, one must also realize that laws on paper is one thing, and how they are honored is something else. But basically, women are still allowed to go to the university and to study and to have a profession afterward. But there are restrictions. There are definitely some disciplines they're not allowed. They're really close to them. The engineering, physics, maths, all the sciences that are considered masculine sciences, women are not allowed to go there.
When you talk about the destruction of the secular nation state, is this a phenomenon that you see happening elsewhere in the world?
I see it as a growing trend nowadays. I see it in the United States.
In what way here in the United States do you see
Well, you see the extremely well-organized Christian coalition, and that's only one group, who demand not only the right of religious people to have prayer in schools, in public schools, to ban abortion, who stand by their Christian moral values, but they do it through the political process. In the next elections, we're going to see happening what happened in the last election, where the Republican Party is having to deal with a very strong presence of the Christian coalition group. You see it in countries like Israel, where the religious right is getting more and more vociferous in its demands. And so, like in the Muslim world, you see it in India. Who had ever heard before of fundamentalist Hinduism? But we see it happening. And all these, in their various manifestations, these religious fundamentalist movement, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, or whatever, are really trying to assault the very definition of a secular nation state.
In order for democracy to work, do you think that religion and the government must be kept separate?
I would say that you cannot have true democracy without a separation of church and state. Having said that, I also know as a historian that it is possible to have a state that declares itself belonging to one faith or another, and yet still be successful in instituting all the necessary institutions that would allow greater political participation than in the dictatorial regimes. I don't think that there is anything inherent in Christianity or Judaism that makes it more favorable to the building up of democratic institutions, let's say more than Islam. I think basically there is practically no difference in the sense between Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. The fact that the Western Christian world and Israel in the 20th century were more successful in building up political democratic institutions than the Muslim world is a matter of historical development rather than religious doctrines.
My guest on this edition of Common Ground is Mongo Bayat, who is currently teaching Iranian history at the University of Bonn. She's the author of numerous books and articles on Iranian politics and society. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics, and please listen at the end of the broadcast for details on how to order. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. We've been using the term fundamentalist to describe the Islamic revolutionaries in the Middle East, but my guest, Mongo Bayat, has a problem with that term.
And the reason why is that the term fundamentalist is not to be found in any of the Muslim languages. In fact, the quote-unquote Islamic fundamentalist individuals themselves have a hard time accepting the term fundamentalism. It doesn't exist in their languages, be it Persian, Turkish, Arabic in all its various dialects, or Asian languages. It is not even a French term. Fundamentalism doesn't exist in French. With the rise of fundamentalism, they try to use the term intégrisme. But now they revert more and more to the term fundamentalism because it has gained currency. It's an Anglo-Saxon word.
It's
an American term. Because you do have historic precedents for Christian fundamentalism in the United States, peculiarly in the United States, not in Western Europe. And so it has gained currency.
I think the way it's been defined here is that the adherents to Islamic fundamentalism, to use that word, say that they're going back to the roots or the fundamentals of Islam.
That is a fairly good definition. I like to use the word revivalism. But then, here I'll have to make a distinction. There was Islamic revivalism in the 50s and 60s that was essentially a social and cultural movement. And they felt its spokesmen were, or spokeswomen, felt threatened by the rise of communism or excessive Westernism. And that was a response to it. But in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there is another kind of Islamic revivalism, and that is political Islamic revivalism. And here, scholars who have worked on comparative fundamentalism, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or any other religious fundamentalist movement, use the term fundamentalism strictly to refer to the political religious activist movements.
And so this is a new kind of Islam that you see taking shape.
Absolutely.
And one of the basic elements of it is the destruction of the secular nation state.
That is their first task.
After the Cold War ended between the United States and the Soviet Union, there was a lot of talk here in the United States about, well, who is our new enemy? And Islam was chosen as the new enemy of the West in the post-Cold War world. Do you see that happening?
It has happened. I was reading a couple of months ago an abstract of a speech by the Secretary General of NATO in Europe, where they were discussing the future policies of NATO, and especially in the Mediterranean region. And the Secretary General specifically said, communism is gone, that threat is gone, but the Western world now has one major new threat, and that is Islamic fundamentalism. I disagree. I think Islamic fundamentalism is first and foremost a threat to the Muslim societies from within, to the secular nation state in the Muslim world, more than it is to the Western world. But having said that, I also fully realize that there are smaller groups of Islamic fundamentalists, very extremists, terrorists. And I don't think they're doing that for Islam, but frankly, don't ask me what are they doing it for. But they are visible, audible, and they are involved in international acts of terrorism and violence. And it is these sporadic, isolated events that give credence to the claims of some Western politicians that, yes, the new threat is Islamic fundamentalism. I don't think it is, but we do see occasionally acts of terrorism in the name of Islam being done. But they must be viewed as acts of terrorism, like the IRA were act of terrorism. You're not going to label all Irish people as terrorists or Catholic Irish as terrorists, we should not do the same mistake. I understand the Western world needs a new enemy, but Islamic fundamentalism is not it.
Well, we certainly see the idea of Islam being an enemy taking shape in the American psyche with the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma in April. The immediate suspect was Middle Eastern terrorists.
It was evidence of something I fear in this country, and that is the unleashing of ugly sentiments. The mass hysteria as a result directed against Muslims. I fear it. And yes, I was relieved, but not less appalled, that the terrorists this time were Americans and not Muslims. But it doesn't mean that it may not occur again, that some crazy Muslim terrorist will have an act of violence in the United States and will succeed in an unleashing. I can foresee it may happen again, but what we should do is to prevent the unleashing of this ugliness, to sort of try, and that is really the task of the media, to calm the populace, to inform the public. But we have seen, unfortunately, that the rumors that spread immediately after the terrorist acts, the media people themselves spread the rumor that there were Middle Eastern-looking individuals seen in the scene of crime. Now, the public wouldn't have known if it weren't for the media spreading these rumors. They have to be much more responsible. And at stake is not just the reputation of Islam or the reputation and well-being of the Muslims living in the United States. At stake is the constitutionality of life in America.
When you talk about this new political Islam being more of a threat to Muslims living in these countries, is that because you fear that they are going to be stripped of rights that they have gained under the development of a secular nation state?
In the United States?
No. People living within...
Look how many intellectuals, politicians, women who refuse to wear the veil have been killed in Algeria.
Thousands.
How many Westerners have been killed? A handful.
Mostly journalists, I think.
And not Americans. In fact, Algeria is being destroyed, the whole infrastructure is being destroyed, but from what I know, the oil companies and oil installation in Algeria is left intact. It should tell us something.
That they are considered necessary for whatever is going to happen in the future?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think it's essentially they are too frightened to provoke the Western powers or Western economic interest in the country.
I'm curious about the leaders in these movements in the Muslim world. These are not poor peasants who are revolting against their position in society, is it? At least the leaders, they may fan the flames of people's discontent, but the leaders are
different from the constituency. Mm-hmm. The constituency may be poor, underprivileged, uneducated, pious Muslims, but the leaders, practically without exception, of Islamic fundamentalism in any Muslim society we take into consideration, are highly sophisticated, modern educated professionals, and that we must make a difference between the constituency and the leadership.
I just had a final question, and I know you're an historian and you look at the past but pretend for a moment that you're one of those political pundits. And do you think that Islamic fundamentalists will take over the Arab world? Is there any chance of that happening?
Let me tell you, I don't foresee its end so soon. But how long will it last?
The end of this fundamentalist movement.
I think there will be greater successes before the end of that movement in the Muslim world. Successes in taking over societies. I don't see an end so soon.
Do you think we're going to see the end of the nation state?
We haven't seen it in Iran so far.
The nation state still exists?
Still exists.
The institutions are still in place?
As I said in my lecture, the state of Islamic Republic has built on the state that existed before, built by the Pahlavis, and before the Pahlavis, the constitutional revolutionary regime that came to power in 1906.
So is it your hope that these institutions and other workings of the nation state will once again be allowed to function without the clerics and the oppression of most of civil society?
Yes, I hope that in an evolutionary way there will be changes and that will allow greater freedom and greater possibilities for the civil society in Iran. I hope so. If I may plead with the public in the United States to try to be better informed about things pertaining to the Middle East and to Islam in general. The Middle East is still a vital to the national interests of the United States, and is going to remain so for at least another 3 or 4 generations. And the United States is the only remaining superpower. And I think it's the responsibility of the public to be better informed and not to fall victim of whatever aspects of the media or mass communication attempt to disinform or misinform.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bayat.
Thank you.
Mangal Bayat has been my guest on Common Ground. She teaches Iranian history at the University of Bonn in Germany. For Common Ground, I'm Mary Gray Davidson. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9532. Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. And again, ask for program number 9532. To order by credit card, you can call toll-free at 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comments about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa. The zip code is 52761. And again, the toll-free number for credit card orders of cassettes and transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by BJ Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.